welcome to Power Play. I'm Vashi Kapelos. Tonight, budget sneak peek.
Inflation, which was 5.9% in January, is still too high.
Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland sets the stage for her upcoming budget. What's in it for you? Her Associate Minister Randy Boissonneau is here in moments, and I'll ask him. And the opposition is standing by to weigh in with their takes. Then, the House of Commons returns, and so too do allegations of foreign interference.
We need to know exactly what she knew and what the Prime Minister knew. Only she can answer these questions.
Tory leader Pierre Poilievre will force a vote in the House over whether the Prime Minister's chief of staff should be questioned. Will she be forced onto the hot seat? Our front bench will break it down coming up. Plus, a meeting like no other. China's President Xi travels to Moscow to sit down with Vladimir Putin as Russia seeks to bolster its war chest. But Ukraine's allies are not receding. In fact, Poland will send the war-torn country fighter jets, even as Putin pledges to destroy the planes. We'll talk about that in an exclusive interview with a member of Poland's cabinet just ahead. But first,
we will invest in strengthening Canada's universal public health care system. And, Matt, we will invest in building Canada's clean economy. Investments in our economic capacity are fiscally responsible. And failure to make the necessary investments in our economic capacity and in our economic future, that is irresponsible and that is reckless.
Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland there laying out two key priorities for next week's federal budget, health care and investing in the green economy. We already know what's coming for health care. That's the 10-year, $196 billion federal provincial health agreement. $46 billion of that is new money. The question mark, though, still hovers around green economy spending. We know the feds will need to spend big to compete with Biden's massive business subsidies south of the border, but how will they do that and exercise restraint, as the minister just promised to do? With me now, her Associate Minister of Finance, Randy Boissonneau. Hi, Minister. Good to see you, as always. Thank you for making the time.
My pleasure, Vashi. Great to see you, too.
I want to start off on that question of restraint, because the Deputy Prime Minister today said that your government will exercise fiscal restraint in the budget, but you're up against a lot, right? We've got spending to counter the IRA, those huge health care investments, affordability measures she's signaling along with the Prime Minister now, new ones for Canadians struggling with inflation. I just have a simple question. What does your government mean by restraint?
So, look, Vashi, the quickest way for me to lose my job as Associate Minister of Finance is to telegraph what might be in the budget in any substantive way. But I will say that you have put the goalposts out there very well. So, on one hand, we know that we need to keep investing in Canadians who are struggling with affordability. We need to, you know, make good on the commitments we've made to provinces and Canadians on the health pillar. And then we have to respond to and really grow for the future with that 21st century green economy. And when it comes to leveling the playing field, or at least making sure that we're playing to our strengths and doing what we need to do, it's not like the IRA woke us up to this field. We've invested $120 billion in the green economy already. And when you take a look at what's been in our other budget documents, carbon capture, use and storage, for example, we've already committed billions of dollars to this. And I think the proof's in the pudding, Vashi, when you look at Canada's ability to land the Volkswagen EV battery plant in St. Thomas, Ontario. That's an example of Canada competing on the world stage and winning for long-term, high-quality paying jobs for the future for Canadians.
And certainly, Minister, it's great that we landed that agreement, but it also kind of brings me back to my original question, which is, we don't know, we have no transparency at this juncture about how much your government had to spend to land that deal, and therefore what the overall implications are for the budget. So when I ask about restraint, it's because it seems, just to an average person like me, to be impossible when you lay out all the spending you're prepared to do. Are you kind of selling Canadians a false bill of goods by characterizing it as restraint?
Well, I think what's really important for us is to, you know, when you compare with the amount that we had to invest over the last 2 to 3 years in Canadians to get us through the pandemic, there will certainly be, you know, a change in quantum there. And I think what's important, Vashi, is to really put in the window the things that we've already done. Like, for 7 years, we've been investing in what economists call the supply side of the economy. What does that mean? That means investments that allow our economy to grow. And so When we take a look at the Canada Child Benefit, when we take a look at dental benefits, when we take a look at the child care agreement that we have, all of this allows the economy to grow and also in a way that doesn't put price on inflation. What you heard the Deputy Prime Minister and Finance Minister say really clearly in her speech is we want to be very careful to not add any fuel to inflation. 5.9% is still too high. That said, when you take a look at the last statement from the Bank of Canada governor, we look at inflation being about 3% this summer, 2.6% by December. That's good news for Canadians who are feeling the pinch, and that's why a combination of those affordability measures plus health care plus competing with our American cousins, if you will, is really important. And Vashi, you're right, like we can't match the equivalent of $2 trillion, but we will play to our strengths on electric vehicles, on hydrogen, on greening the economy, right, on green electricity grids, and we will do so in a way that's going to create great union jobs and great paying jobs across the country.
Minister, if I understood the first part of your answer, though, the definition your government is operating on when it comes to restraint is spending less than you did in the pandemic. I mean, you spent a record level of money in the pandemic. Obviously, there was a heightened level of need then. I'm not disagreeing with that at all. But is that the proper metric to be judging kind of fiscal responsibility going forward?
Well, I think if you take a look at the state of the economy and take a look at how well the economy is doing, Vashi, and if you take a look at what we're talking about in this budget, we can't tell you what's going to be in the budget until the Deputy Prime Minister and Finance Minister actually shares the budget with us next Tuesday. But it will be a prudent budget. It will be a fiscally responsible budget because we need to make sure that we're not adding to inflation, but we've set out the pillars very carefully and very clearly. Like, Canadians needed to see that we could actually meet the challenge of a modern healthcare system, and so we're going to lay track down for that for the next 10 years. And we cannot miss this golden opportunity, this historic opportunity, to really position ourselves, whether it's critical minerals, whether it's electric vehicles, whether it's the green electricity grid, to really compete with, but also welcome the world to Canada. And so it's an important fiscal frame, and you'll see on Tuesday exactly what we mean by fiscal restraint.
And I take your point about it coming Tuesday. I just have some really quick questions for you then on sort of trying to ascertain for Canadians what might or might not happen in that vein under the framing that your government has positioned. So, for example, if you're going to still be fiscally responsible or exercise fiscal restraint, that means that you have to pay for the stuff that you're talking about either through making cuts elsewhere or raising taxes. So, very simple question: does your government plan to add any new additional taxes in this budget?
Well, you know my answer to that, Vashi, is going to be stay tuned for the budget. But our government has been very responsible about making sure that we had a tax cut for the middle class right off the start, but that we've also added the ability of government to respond to the challenges of Canadians. And maybe, Vashi, just for people to get a sense of what we're talking about when we're competing with the Americans, in my own home city of Edmonton, earlier this year, we announced that Air Products is going to set up the world's largest net zero hydrogen plant, a $1.6 billion investment, to which the Canadian government put $300 million into that. We've already seen other companies now build off of that particular installation, and so coast to coast to coast, you're going to see these kind of markers put down for the future economy, all while we're heading towards net zero, all while we're making sure that we have good paying jobs for Canadians. And when it comes to what's in the budget, stay tuned for Tuesday.
Okay. Because respectfully, my question was around you saying that your government is able to signal, for example, that there will be new affordability measures. I think it would be fair to signal that there won't be new taxes, but I understand that you don't want to do that. Just really quickly, I have 10 seconds left before you mentioned net zero. The IPCC came out with a really significant report today that basically says you have to be more aggressive. Everyone has to be more aggressive in their targets and move actually that net zero target from 2050 to 2040. Will that be reflected in this budget? Will there be more money to reach a more aggressive goal?
Minister Guilbeault and I have talked about this, and we're going to take the International Climate Change Panel recommendations. We're going to look at them. We're going to study them. I can tell you that you've already heard one of the pillars of this budget, which is to green the Canadian economy. That includes everything from greening the grid to making sure that we are able to compete on the global stage. When it comes to the IPCC's report, we'll study it, and we'll get back to you the next time we have time to chat.
Okay. I look forward to that. Minister Boissonneau, thanks very much for making the time
this
evening. And let's get some opposition reaction to what you've been listening to with me this evening, Conservative finance critic Jasraj Singh Hallan and NDP finance critic Daniel Blakey. Hi, Mr. Hallan. Hi, Mr. Blakey. Good to have you both here. Mr.
Thanks
Hallan,
for having us.
I want to start off with you. you and your party have criticized this government for, as you would characterize it, making life less affordable for Canadians. We heard the finance minister and her colleague, Minister Boissonneau, today signal that there would be things like expanded dental care in this budget, perhaps the expansion, the NDP is asking for, of the GST rebate. If you were, in fact, so worried about affordability for Canadians, would you not support those measures?
Vashi, look, I think what we need to look at is how do we make things more affordable, and in the sense that we need to bring home more powerful paychecks, better paychecks. We need to help bring down lower prices, which means including getting rid of taxes that the minister, again, would not confirm whether they would get rid of taxes, but we know there's going to be an increase in carbon tax, there's going to be an escalator tax, and a second carbon tax that they're going to bring in. We need to get rid of those taxes in order to make sure that Canadians can keep more in their pocket. We need stronger paychecks. We need to make sure that we're getting regulatory burden out of the way so more projects can get built. By doing that, we can make sure that we are more competitive against the IRA and that we can have good Canadian jobs stay in Canada. At the end of the day, those are the measures that we would do in order to make sure that more Canadians can keep more in their pocket and have stronger paychecks.
And I take your point about Canadians wanting to keep more money in their pockets, but respectfully, for example, with the carbon tax, and I'm not sure exactly what you're talking about with the second carbon tax there, but that's in an effort to mitigate the effects of climate change, which today the IPCC says are worse than ever. We're on a terrible track, really, to a more expensive future with catastrophic effects of climate change. Your party has not proposed anything to substitute what the carbon tax would do to mitigate those effects or to reduce emissions. So is it credible for you to say get rid of it when you don't have an alternative plan?
And we do have an alternative plan, but before I get to that, let's see what this carbon tax has accomplished so far. It's made the cost of gas, groceries, and home heating more expensive. Yet the Liberals have not met a single emission reduction target, and emissions have gone up since they've introduced it.
But that's not the way to assess the carbon tax solely. It's right. It's how much more would they have gone up without it?
And we don't have any proof of if that would happen. They've missed every single target. Conservatives are calling for technology and not taxes. We need to support the industry that would help bring down the emissions that are going on right now. And another thing, we could actually help world emissions come down if we replace dirty dictator oil, like we've seen around the world, with clean, responsible, low-carbon energy that we have here. We had 15 good LNG projects that could have helped replace some of the dirty dictator oil. For example, Germany came to Canada and asked us that we want your energy. The Prime Minister said there was no business case. They turned around to Qatar. They got it from there, where there aren't any human rights regulations on it or environmental regulations. We could have been a world leader if we had gotten pipelines built and if we could have gotten our product to market and gotten projects built. But the problem is there's two problems. There's regulatory government burden, which are the gatekeepers, like Bill C-69, that's not getting any projects built. That's actually stifling
our
economy.
Well, there weren't a lot built economy. Under the previous government either, to be respectful.
But this Bill C-69 is going to stop projects. By the Liberals' own admission, okay, it takes up to 25 years to get a project built, and Canada is 64th when it comes to getting permits built, permits approved under this government.
Okay.
We need to get rid of those burdens so we can be the world leader.
Let me stick on this subject, because a lot of the stuff that the federal government, Mr. Blakey, is talking about doing, especially where affordability is concerned, comes off of proposals from your party, right? You're in an agreement right now to keep them in power, so it kind of makes sense. When your leader was asked about how to pay for it, he talked about the subsidies that go to oil companies that are very much around carbon capture. Part of the problem with the IRA is that it offers a production credit for carbon capture that has seen already one company based out of Alberta, I think it's called Entropy, decide to put all of its carbon capture investment south of the border. Isn't stuff like that necessary? Aren't those kinds of subsidies necessary to compete with the United States?
Well, I think there's still the question of where we want to compete with them. And the fact of the matter is that carbon capture and storage hasn't been proven at scale. And so the question is that really the place to put all your eggs? Our answer to that question is no. We don't think that's the place for Canada to make the big spend on transforming our energy economy to meet the needs of the future. We think that there are other places where we would get more value for public investment when it comes to greening our grid and preparing for electrification. So for us, it's a question of opportunity cost, a technology that really hasn't been proven at scale versus other things that we could be
investing
in.
Even if the U.S. is pursuing it, kind of...
Well, I think what we've heard in a number of, it's not just my word you can take for it, a lot of economists have said, look, Canada, you know, the U.S. is firing on all barrels with the IRA. Canada's not going to compete with the United States on every item in the IRA, so we have to choose carefully. New Democrats don't believe that using what public funds we have in Canada to compete on carbon capture and storage is the best way to electrify our economy, lower our emissions, and create the kinds of jobs that we all want to see for Canadians. So one of our contributions to the fall economic statement was to insist very strongly on having language like the Biden administration has put around their investment in clean tech, ensuring that there are good paying jobs with good benefits as part of that package. That's something that we have continued to push for investments that we may see coming up in the budget.
Do you want to see them explicitly tied to union jobs?
We're quite comfortable with that. That's something that the U.S. administration has done, and we've said that they should be adopting the same approach as the Biden administration. So that means, yes, good-paying union jobs being the backbone of these public investments, because we think that's the best way to get the maximum value for that public investment for actual Canadian workers, as opposed to just the companies that they would work for.
I just have 20 seconds left for a follow-up, but you also are asking for a windfall tax in order to generate more revenue.
Yeah.
The Prime Minister has dismissed it as simplistic and said that those costs, that extra tax, will be borne on consumers. Doesn't he have a point?
Well, look, we've seen other jurisdictions do this. So the UK has implemented, in fact, a Conservative government in the UK has implemented a
windfall tax. But to what degree
did
that actually lower inflation for people in the UK? They're still under some of the highest
rates. Well, if I could come back to your conversation with Jazz on affordability, I would say this is a major difference between Conservatives and New Democrats when it comes to affordability. They would say that widespread tax relief is the only way to really make things affordable for Canadians. We would point out to the many companies that have been jacking up prices on everything from housing to groceries, oil and gas, in order to eat up Canadians' disposable income, because the market will charge what the market can bear. Our approach has been to try and concentrate on bringing down the price of things that Canadians can't do without: dental care, prescription drugs. And we think there are other areas. Child care is another example where New Democrats have fought for a long time in order to be able to lower that cost, because we believe that by lowering the cost of things that people can't do without, we actually create more room for disposable income, because if the disposable income is what's left over when people have paid for the things they can't do without, then
it still adds to demand in the economy, though potentially increases inflation.
But companies are competing to get disposable income after Canadians have paid for housing, prescription drugs, and childcare, instead of competing for the money that should be going to those things for Canadians to be able to access.
I'm out of time. Thank you very much, both of you, for your time. I'm sure we will be convening many times in the lead up to and right after the budget next week. Thanks so much, Dasra Singh-Hallan and Daniel Blakey. And we will be talking about Minister Freeland's budget balancing act tonight with the front bench. Up this evening, Carlene Varian, Melanie Paradis, Kathleen Monk, and Emily Nicolas. First, though, let's head south of the border, where barricades were unloaded in front of the Manhattan Criminal Court this morning, the city already bracing for the potential arrest of Donald Trump. This weekend, the former president tried to rally supporters, posting on social media that he believes he'll be arrested tomorrow in a Manhattan district attorney investigation into allegations of hush money payments to adult film star Stormy Daniels. It would be a historic first indictment of a former president. His former vice president, Mike Pence, insists in an interview with ABC News an indictment would be politically motivated.
It just feels like a politically charged prosecution here. And I, for my part, just feel like it's just not what the American people want to see. President Trump can take care of himself.
However, Donald Trump's rallying cry has not brought out masses of protesters, and the Manhattan DA hasn't indicated charges are actually coming. So joining us now with the latest is CTV's Washington Bureau Chief Joy Malbin. Hi, Joy. Help us understand, is the former president actually getting arrested tomorrow?
Yeah, that's the billion-dollar question. It truly is. He says he's basing it on media reports. But there are two more witnesses today. His own lawyer, Bob Costello, who is standing up for Donald Trump, versus Michael Cohen, Trump's former fixer, who says that he wrote the checks for $130,000 to Stormy Daniels in order to silence her before the 2016 presidential election. So unless Donald Trump has some kind of aura or seeing through to the future, we're not sure, but if he is, he would have a mugshot, he would be fingerprinted, and of course they'd have to negotiate some kind of surrender.
And talk a little bit, if you could, Joy, about this call to rally supporters in particular. I mean, that, but also combined with the fact that much of the GOP is jumping to his defense.
Yeah, look, New York City is not taking any chances. They're building a ring of steel around the courthouse. They're putting security cameras up, especially since this echoes Donald Trump's cry that resulted in that deadly insurrection on January 6th on Capitol Hill. Certainly, most Republicans are coming to his defense, calling it a political witch hunt. But Ron DeSantis, who could possibly be a presidential rival to Donald Trump, who intends to run again, took a good shot at his former president, saying, look, I don't know anything about these hush money payments. I don't know anything about it. So it's setting up for quite the rival. So we'll have to see. But, you know, Donald Trump does have a lot of diehard supporters, certainly in Florida. Some people are posting fake video on social media showing Trump flags, but they're all wearing T-shirts. So it's not this time of year. Still, New York is not taking any chances.
Joy, thanks so much. Appreciate it. CTV's Washington Bureau Chief Joy Malbin for us in D.C. Up next here on Power Play, China's president meets his Russian counterpart. How are allies helping Ukraine prepare for Moscow's spring offensive? We are one-on-one with a member of Poland's cabinet on that country's plan to send fighter jets next.
China and China's leadership needs to understand the stakes here and needs to understand that Vladimir Putin is on the wrong side of history.
The deputy prime minister there condemning Chinese President Xi Jinping's three-day visit to Russia, and she's not the only one. Here's U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
That President Xi is traveling to Russia days after the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for President Putin suggests that China feels no responsibility to hold the Kremlin accountable for the atrocities committed in Ukraine, and instead of even condemning them, it would rather provide diplomatic cover for Russia to continue to commit those very crimes.
Against the backdrop of that trip, allies do continue to ramp up military support for Ukraine, though. Poland, in particular, now says it will send its neighbor fighter jets. A month ago, Poland was insisting it could only do so in concert with other allies. I spoke to Cabinet Minister Adam Niedzielski in an exclusive interview earlier. I started off by asking him what's behind that decision.
You know, from the very, very beginning of the war, we tried to help Ukrainian people in a very different ways. I mean that we accepted over 1.5 million refugees in Poland. We welcomed them. We gave them all the public services that are available for Polish citizens. And the other step was, of course, a military equipment. In this case, we started, for example, to form coalition to transfer tanks to Ukraine, and we begin this kind of activity, and some of countries followed us, and of course before we had some kind of a consultation. We applied the same model in the case of jets. We are trying to present a position that of course we are ready to transfer jets, but we also have to make some kind of consultation with our allies. To be honest, we of course are after consultation, but nevertheless is the result of the consultation we will transfer those jets to Ukraine, because the most important issue for us is that this is also our war. I mean that people fighting in Ukraine against Russian, we have the feeling that they are also defending our borders. This is not the case of too much discussion. We have simply to help them.
You referenced the decision around tanks, and Poland again was first out of the gate to say we are willing to supply those, and to kind of say at the same time you hope that other allies come together and do the same, and they did. Do you expect the same thing to happen with jets? Do you anticipate other allies will end up supplying fighter jets?
In this question is a little bit complicated situation, because in order to have these jets operate effectively, You have to have adequate infrastructure, I mean pilots trained. So we first think about the equipment that was used in ex-communist countries. So we first of all think about our close allies, I mean like Slovakia, like other countries that still have on their state these kinds of jets.
One more question on this, then I want to ask you about healthcare. In particular, I take your point about the type of jet. Beyond what you're talking about, Ukraine has asked very specifically for the United States to supply F-16s. Do you anticipate that will eventually happen?
We can see from that time, from the case of tanks, that sometimes situation changes very dynamically. I mean that we have some kind of position which is at the very beginning, assessed as a controversial. I mean the very first position on tanks was also commented by French, by Germans, not as a very good position. But then after this kind of consultation, after our will to transfer all this equipment to Ukraine, they cannot have any other alternative. They had to also donate, they had to also give as a gift this tank. So I think that the situation is very dynamical. We have a very good diplomacy. Our Prime Minister, President and Minister of Foreign Affairs really make a lot of talks with our allies, and I think that until now we are quite effective, so I think that we can be effective also in the future.
You oversee Minister Healthcare in Poland, and you mentioned that Poland has welcomed 1.5 million refugees, now more than a year, of course, after the war started. So many of them initially came through Poland in the first place. I was reading that your country has many of the same challenges that our country does in the healthcare system, a shortage of doctors, for example,
yes,
things like that. How are you able to absorb all the extra people who need healthcare in Poland?
First of all, we defined a very specific model for this kind of healthcare. I mean that we try to transfer those patients that require long-term treatment to other countries. So we organized a special hub near Rzeszów, which is dedicated to patients who are transferred to other European countries. The idea behind this model is that we have all the time have some potential of accepting patients from Ukraine, because in case any crisis happens, we have to be ready to accept patients. So the first assumption is that we try to transfer part of these patients, especially that require long-term treatment, to other countries. The second issue is that we try to help Ukrainian patients in that way that we do not only accept them near the border. We try to transfer them to the other parts of Poland.
And just finally, before I let you go, Minister, another thing we have in common, or that we do in common, is train medics in Poland who are going to help out with people who are injured in Ukraine. In fact, I believe Canada just sent some more to Poland. What can you tell us about that?
Yes, this is a very important project for Poland, of course, but this is a very important project for Ukraine. I mean, there is a huge demand for a training for Ukrainian doctors, especially in that area of battlefield medicine. I mean, they have their own experience, but still they need a training, an exchange of experience. So Poland is also hub for training, not only for logistics, for patients, but also for training. I know that Canadian volunteers are involved in giving this training to Ukrainian doctors, and we are very happy about it. I mean that this help is very much needed. But also we organize this kind of training in Ukraine. I mean that we also send our specialists there. We're trying to give them this kind of knowledge also where it is needed.
Okay, Minister, I'll leave it there. Thank you very much
Thank
for making
much.
The time, and safe travels.
Thank you very much.
That is Poland's health minister. Coming up on Power Play tonight, Tories have set their sights on the prime minister's chief of staff. And they brought their fight to see her question on foreign interference to the House of Commons. Is their motion to compel her to testify on foreign interference going to work? Our front bench panel will dig into that. There they are, coming up next. Stay with us.
Only the leader of the NDP will decide. He is the deciding vote. So the question for him is, will he help his boss, the prime minister, cover up, or will he vote for the prime minister's chief of staff to testify?
Our government has always been very transparent with Canadians.
The question was for the NDP leader. I don't know if he's a part of the government. He should be able to get up and answer questions.
When the leader of the opposition was actually in charge of democratic institutions, he stood idly by and did nothing.
A lot of that back and forth stemming from the fact that the Conservatives have tabled a motion that, if passed, will compel the Prime Minister's Chief of Staff, Katie Telford, to testify before a committee on foreign election interference. The motion also wants testimony from Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland, Public Safety Minister Marco Minicino, the Clerk of the Privy Council, the Head of CSIS, the list goes on and on. The Tories want the forum for that testimony to be the House's Committee on Access to Information, Privacy and Ethics, and that's a committee conserved by the Tories. A reminder that another committee, this one called the House Affairs and Procedure one, is already studying foreign interference, but that committee is dominated by the Liberals. A vote on the Conservatives' motion is set for tomorrow. Let's bring in the front bench to unpack all of that and the politics of it. Carlene Varian is the former chief of staff to Jim Carr. She's an associate vice president with Summa Strategies. Melanie Paradis is the former communications director to Erin O'Toole. She's now the president of Texture Communications. Kathleen Monk is an NDP strategist and principal owner of Monk and Associates. And Le Devoir columnist Emily Nicolas is here tonight as well. Hi, everybody.
Hey there.
Nice to see you. Kathleen, I'll start with you on this one. That's a lot of, like, what's happening on the Hill. But let's step back for a second. Mm-hmm. This has been a dominant political issue for the last month.
For so long.
Is this move by the Tories to force this to the House floor, is that something that keeps it in the headlines?
They're trying. They're trying really, really hard. They're using an opposition day motion to try to bring this to the House. It'll come to a vote tomorrow. So far, you know, the NDP is holding their cards pretty close to their chest in terms of how they're going to vote on that. But the reason why the Conservatives have taken this measure to use this motion in the House is because the committee you mentioned, PROC, has been filibustered, right? Mm. And they're trying to prevent the staffers from coming to testify. But listen, preventing staffers from testifying is kind of a cross-partisan ploy. In fact, Pierre Poilievre has done it himself. He tried to prevent Nigel Wright. He prevented staffers coming out on the In-N-Out scandal, on his own kind of breach of some conservative partisan things that he did when he was minister. He prevented staffers from testifying. So it kind of muddies the waters a little bit. Everyone's done a little bit of this. But whether the question you're really asking is, does this have legs? How will the story continue? Ultimately, I think it comes down to this. It's like, will we continue to have this political grandstanding? I think probably the New Democrats will say no. They'll be like, we don't care. We'd rather see things like dental care and people helped in the budget. We don't want to go to an election right now. Can you imagine if an election is we come into an election tomorrow, if somehow the prime minister calls us into a confidence vote, and what, just before Biden comes to town, we're going to throw.
Yeah, could you like have more excitement?
Yeah,
this
I mean,
week,
this
sure.
week is pretty busy as it is. So, you know, but I just don't think it's going to happen, because I think ultimately the choice for New Democrats is we want to get stuff done for people. We're less into the political grandstanding.
I think that's true to a degree, Melanie, but I would say, for example, that the New Democrats today in question period led with questions about a public inquiry. They have been pretty specific on wanting a public inquiry versus a lot of the other mechanisms out there. Probably if pushed on a confidence vote, I would be shocked if they go further on that. But everybody is still, to a certain degree, at least on the Hill, talking about that. My question is really whether that keeps the issue going.
Well, I don't think that this needs to be a confidence vote. And the Prime Minister's office, ultimately, the Liberals get to decide if this is a confidence vote or not. And there's no need for it to be. Like, there's no need for the government to fall on this issue. Just have the committee. Let's have the investigation. I don't understand why people won't go and testify. Katie Telford has testified to committee twice before already, during Wee and General Vance. The Conservatives have had staff testify as well. Guy Giorno testified. So this is not completely out of the ordinary or unusual. And as you mentioned at the top, there are a lot of other people who this motion would request to come and testify at committee to provide really important evidence about election interference, so that Canadians, since we're not getting the national inquiry that people have been asking for, Canadians would at least have some more clarity, some more information from senior bureaucrats, from elected officials, from key staff, including staff on national campaign teams for all of the main parties. So they're calling for a lot of people to come in and share what they know with Canadians at this committee. And I think it's an important motion. It'll be really interesting to see how people vote today. But this does not need to be a confidence vote. And I think if the Liberals make it one, that's really telling you something.
Yeah, Carlene, does your gut tell you one way or the other if they would?
No, they're not going to make this a confidence vote for many of the reasons that have been talked about in the last few minutes, but also just because there are far bigger fish to fry for the Government of Canada right now. I think that at this point, regrettably, and partly due perhaps to how the issue was handled by the Prime Minister in the early weeks of this controversy, but also just by a lot of the partisanship that's been tossed back and forth over the last number of weeks between the Conservatives and the Liberals, we are in a place now where, if you take a step back and you were to check in with Canadians, some level of public trust has sort of been shaken in the stability and the security of our democratic institutions. And so the real question that we ought to be asking ourselves is, what can we do to restore that? What needs to be fixed? How can we make our institutions more robust? I don't think any of those questions are really the intended solutions that are going to come out of this committee hearing. If the Conservatives have their way and they get it, I think it will be a lot more just opportunity for gotcha lines. Kathleen mentioned, you know, how this idea of staffers testifying at committees is something that generally any party in government will be opposed to, because the base principle is ministerial accountability, mm-hmm. of course. It's not the staff who advise you. But what I really hope that will come of all of this eventually is, again, looking at ways to actually strengthen our election systems, whether municipally, federally, provincially. What can we do to ensure that they're more secure? I don't see a lot of that motivation behind the opposition's push right now, but I do hope we'll get there.
Emily, last word to you on this. What do you think comes of this?
I think the summum of irony would be to have a story about China interfering in our election and it resulting in an election that would not have happened if it wasn't for a story about China. And I think that irony needs to not be lost on anyone, and that's why I don't believe at this point that this is, you know, that this will go beyond the level of excitement that we're seeing on the Hill already. The Bloc and the NDP have both been pushing for a public inquiry, and so for them to be dying on the Hill of having a staffer at a parliamentary committee that they say is not enough to go at the bottom of the story, it would also be incoherent given the argument that they've been having, instead of just really pushing for that public inquiry to happen and just even not participating, for example, in the consultation on the nomination of David Johnson for that exact reason as well. So it'd be quite incoherent for them to make that that their last hill to stand on. And also, we need to remember that, you know, budget is coming up, Joe Biden is coming up, and of course, what's been going on in question period is people trying to make sure that this story stays on top of mind for Canadians. It's working up to a point, but it's not enough, I think, given what else is going on in government, to actually make that the number one story like it was a week ago or 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, we'll have to see what happens tomorrow when they do vote. We'll be watching that closely. I'm going to take a quick commercial break. On the other end of that break, the front bench is sticking around. We're going to talk about the upcoming federal budget and the finance minister's budget balancing act. Stay with us. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Power Play. Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland is indicating her budget will exercise fiscal restraint while also providing targeted inflation relief and making significant, as she calls them, investments in healthcare and the green economy. How hard will threading that needle be politically and practically? Let's bring back our front bench panel to talk about that. Carlene Varian, Melanie Paradis, Kathleen Monk, and Emily Nicola. Melanie, I'll start with you. I'm just going to pick up on that question. How difficult, I'll start politically, will threading that needle be?
politically, I think we're going to see a lot of like green words just thrown into press releases and announcements at green projects. But how much is actually being greened by this? I don't know. I think that the focus, frankly, rightfully, in her remarks today was on restraint. And I do hope that that's what we see in this budget. I think she was sending a very important signal to the market, which has been incredibly volatile, especially with, you know, the banking industry challenges that we've seen in the past 2 weeks, that restraint is what they can expect and that this won't be some, you know, bank-breaking budget, that they can instead expect that the government is going to be doing things to shore up that trust in the system again. I think over the weekend, we saw some really important things happening with banking, especially out of Europe, with Credit Suisse having to be bought out. I think it's important to note that their government had to pass emergency legislation in order to allow that acquisition to take place, to keep that bank from failing. And just in the last segment, we were talking about how sort of dysfunctional our parliament is right now and how difficult it is for this minority government to move things forward. And I worry that if we had to deal with something like that in Canada, would we be able to move that quickly to take that kind of a decisive action? I'm not entirely sure. So again, I think in the Deputy Prime Minister's remarks today, she made some really important signals to the market about restraint. And I hope that we actually see that in the budget next week.
I did try to ask her Associate Minister Emily kind of how the government is defining that up against all those big investments they're signaling they have to make. And he didn't provide a definitive answer, but at one point sort of indicated, well, it's going to be a difference in quantum, I think he said, a lot smaller than the pandemic level of spending. Is that enough to kind of send those signals that Melanie's talking about?
Because the signals are inherently relative and political and emotional in a way, I think yes. If something feels small, regardless of the actual numbers, if it feels smaller and it feels restrained, it will be sending that signal. I think to understand the piece about green tech, it's important just to remind ourselves of the context of the Inflation Reduction Act in the United States and how that was already one of the key focus on her economic update in the fall, and so continuing in that track of really making sure that Canada will not be essentially outdone by the United States in terms of green technology seems to be something that's very important for Chrystia Freeland. But the rest of it is something that, you know, if you've had an ear on the ground in terms of the people who've been participating in pre-budget consultation, different interest groups, what she's been saying in terms of this is going to be a very restrained budget has already been heard, I think, by a lot of different member of civil societies in Canada in terms of having low expectations of what's going to come out of this budget. So I think, if there are people who are saying the government should be spending more on some issues, they will have been warned. This will not necessarily change their mind, but they will have been warned because Chrystia Freeland has been very consistent on warning people that this budget will be relatively lower spending than the last ones.
Yeah, I sort of read between the lines also, and maybe not even the amount of money, but the fact that it won't be spread over lots of different priorities. It seems like she's saying very clearly today and has it a few times, like it's going to countering the IRA, it's going to healthcare and a few things for affordability, and that's pretty much what you should expect.
She's talked about it being much more narrowly focused, so I think that's exactly right. This is, I think, a finance minister who, now that she's into her third budget as finance minister, recognizes the signals that she needs to send to international markets, to Canadian banks, also just to regular Canadians, working families, about what Canada's government has planned for them, and that they have hit that point now where, okay, the cash injections into the economy that were really needed during the post-COVID years, those first few fiscal years afterwards, were really needed, and the counterbalance of rising global inflation that we all saw was sort of part and parcel of what was going on all over the world, but that we've now reached a point where, okay, we do have to pull things back in. because we do not want to put the economy at risk of further aggravating inflation, which is still too high. So I think what you'll see, even when it comes to which people this budget's focused on, is that it's going to be focused on those who stand to feel the effects of that inflation and those affordability issues most acutely, which will be low-income people, working poor, seniors, those kinds of groups of people.
It's more of the same, really, in that vein, Kathleen. The measures that they introduced already to help people who are hit hardest by inflation, mm-hmm. it sounds like it's just going to be an amplification of that.
An extension of that, but I think really, as opposed to the COVID years that Carlene was just pointing out, where it was a fire hose of money, a kind of spray and pray that we were hitting the right people, it's going to be much more targeted, right? Targeted on those three pillars you've mentioned, obviously the industrial strategy around transitioning to a green economy, healthcare for sure, and small targeted measures that she thinks. Because frankly, you can't bank on growth for this budget this year. You know, the parliamentary budget officers already said we're looking at maybe 1% growth. We know that liberals, at the best case scenario, the liberals don't want to cut. They don't want that austerity kind of, they don't want to cut to services to Canadians, really. And so what else can they do? They have to have targeted measures that are limited, and Freeland was out today basically trying to manage those expectations.
Okay, I'm going to leave the discussion there. Thanks so much, everyone. Melanie Paradis, Emily Nicolas, Carlene Varian, and Kathleen Monk. Are they prepared? Is the federal government prepared to add any new taxes in this budget? You can find out in today's Takeaway next. Stay right there.
There are some really vulnerable people in Canada who are really being squeezed by inflation. And we know that we have a responsibility to give them some support. But our approach will be fiscally responsible.
We need stronger paychecks. We need to make sure that we're getting regulatory burden out of the way so more projects can get built.
Our approach has been to try and concentrate on bringing down the price of things that Canadians can't do without: dental care, prescription drugs.
A little taste there of how the finance minister is laying out expectations in advance of the federal budget, which will be tabled by her a week from tomorrow. You also got a sense there of some of the opposition reaction. The minister said today that she plans to exercise, that the federal government will exercise fiscal restraint. But she also said there will be two key pillars, rather, of significant investment. The first is healthcare. The second is countering the IRA and investment in the green economy. Both require a lot of money. Healthcare, we have a sense of. The IRA, countering it, we don't know exactly how much money will go into that. How are they going to do all that and exercise fiscal restraint at the end of the day? I asked Associate Minister, Finance Minister Randy Boisseneau, if the feds plan to hike taxes, if there'll be any new taxes to raise more money to pay for that stuff. Here's what he said.
Well, you know my answer to that, Vashti, is going to be stay tuned for the budget. But our government has been very responsible about making sure that we had a tax cut for the middle class right off the start, but that we've also added the ability of government to respond to the challenges of Canadians.
So you heard it there from Associate Finance Minister Randy Boisseneau. We'll have to stay tuned to the budget to find out if there are any additional taxes. That, of course, happens, as I mentioned, 1 week from tomorrow. I'll leave you there tonight. Up next, the debate with Mike Le Couture right after today's top headlines. Have a great evening.